Yeah, hi, Sandy.
Hello.
You're pre-recording this
Yeah,
chat.
yeah, yeah, yeah. I read that you don't like live chats, but I am pre-recording.
Oh, I do.
No, it's cool. I don't
someone,
care.
someone else said that to me last week in an interview. Said, "I'm really nervous about talking to you," and I said, and "I'm like saying, I'm thinking, why? I'm not intimidating. What's up with you?" And he said, "I read your blog, whatever that means." And he said, you don't like, you think it's a landmine or...
Yes, that is what you said.
Yeah,
or that's what someone wrote anyway.
No, it's me. No, it's all me. Oh, no one writes for me. Oh, nobody writes for me.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. Where are you?
Melbourne, Australia. You've been here?
Oh, that's where I came. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh,
I loved it.
Come back.
Loved it.
Yeah, it's a good city.
I was there with my friend Joe Matera.
Oh, nice.
I'm an optimistic kind of guy, Sandy. My glass is half full. You know, I'm quite famous for living by the moral that the answer is yes. What's the question? I'm like that.
That's a good way to be.
Well, it's the way I am. I don't have self-pity. You know, I spent so many years in hospital as a kid. Between the age of 3 and 16.
I read that.
Yeah, it taught me a lot. It taught me an awful lot. But so there's no self-pity. My dad wouldn't have allowed it. But the deal is, your listeners, while I don't come to Australia very often and have never played a concert there, Rockwiz, I'm on Rockwiz.
Ah.
Yeah, big Rockwiz. See it. It's lovely. I've spent 47 years traveling. It's what I do.
Yeah.
I play 50, 60, 70 concerts every year, all around the UK and all over Europe, all over Scandinavia as well. I mean, so it's not very much fun, this stuff, but first, people come first, and we need everyone to live. We need to live through this and get the vaccination done. And get the world back to rights, you
Absolutely.
Know, back to normality.
How have you been spending your time?
do you know, I can't see where the time has gone. We played 9 shows of a 60-date tour by March the 8th last year. And April, May, June, July in this country, it was... I know that's your winter, but it was like an Australian summer. It was Mediterranean. It was fantastic. And luckily, because I'm lucky, all right? I've had a great career and we have a really super house that we love. And I've got 2 acres of woodland, garden into woodland and orchard. And, you know, I can walk for an hour rambling around my own property without hitting the street, the country lane, you know?
I love it.
So we're very lucky.
Yeah,
it's lovely. And it all through April, May, June, July, August of last year, it was just great to be outdoors all the time. And the time passed. And all I've done basically is practice the guitar.
And you must be quite good by now.
Still practicing, yeah. Yeah, I've been creating my own tunings and I'm sending them to my 2 guitar players in the band and showing them what I'm up to and saying, look, put your that finger there and that finger there and you've got this wonderful sounding chord. Yeah, but Mrs. Harley and I have missed, I've missed... The stage,
yeah,
the live concerts.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, terribly.
Yeah, it's
everyone.
Been a crazy year indeed. You did manage to get that album Uncovered out before this all hit. I guess, I mean, that's the album that you would have taken out on tour with you all year.
Absolutely. 60 shows, yeah. They've all been rescheduled 3 times.
You've got
You gotta laugh. Promoters are being fantastic. My office. Are you, Are you still there?
Yeah.
My office gets offers and we write back, and there's all this, you know, planning going on, rejigging, rescheduling, and the promoters over here and in Europe have been brilliant. They just they're so calm, all these guys. Yeah. I guess they do it all the time.
Maybe
to me
not
and
quite
my,
this
my
bad.
Assistant.
Yeah.
Not quite this crazy, but they're all pretty laid back characters, the promoters and agents. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Sorry, go on.
Go on, no.
You were supposed to be doing a special concert in Glasgow to celebrate your birthday. I guess that one's cancelled, but I do notice on your schedule you're trying to head out again starting March.
Yeah, I mean, we were due to play to 3,000 people in Glasgow on my birthday in about, the 27th of February. Now, that was moved a few months ago. It's happening on March the 5th. 2022. It will be Steve's big birthday plus one. Yeah, it's heartbreaking, but everyone, you know, people are very stoical. And even the fans, I mean, I can tell you out of 2,300 tickets that had sold a year ago, that is, a year ago for this big concert, it would have sold out.
Yeah,
only about 24 have asked for their money back.
Oh, really?
You know, it's because these people couldn't get there in March 2022. They're not saying, "Oh, that's disgusting, pay me back." Right. They're saying, "I can't be there, and I want a refund." But it's a handful.
So you've still got another year to wait until you can head out on tour. What plans have you got for this year?
No, I'm not sure that's true. Vaccination is running at a huge rate of knots. We've had 16 plus million their first jab.
Yeah, you're doing
out
brilliantly
of 56.
There. Yeah.
It's pretty good. I've got to tell you, it's really impressive. And you know, I've had my first one. My wife has not because she's 62. We're not ready for that cohort yet, but it ain't far away.
Yeah.
And when we're all done, you know, by the end of the summer, right down to the 20-year-olds, I think we've got, I don't think I'll be playing before October, but we've got a rock, not my acoustic tour, but we've got Rock Band, like me and Cotney Rebel, the big band, on dates through October, November and December.
Oh, fingers crossed.
I think they might. Oh, yeah.
Steve, you had a pretty wild... Sorry.
Say?
I was just going to go on. You had a pretty wild time through the 70s. You were a bit of a bad boy during that time, weren't you? Hang on.
Yeah, we just...
Sorry,
it was
I'll just do that again. I was getting a call then too. I think it cut you out. It was my daughter calling with her grandchild with my grandchild on FaceTime. I'll go again with that.
FaceTime's a bit of a lifesaver, isn't it?
Isn't it? Especially at the moment. Mine only lives 4 kilometres up the road, but yeah, they FaceTime me every morning.
Nice.
I'll go back on that question again. Steve, you had a bit of a wild time through the 70s, didn't you? I read that you, well, like everybody else, really loved that period of time. You really let your hair hang down.
Yeah, the 70s were hedonistic. There was a lot of money about, and a lot of ticket sales. Live music came alive. You know, in the 60s, when I was a very young teenager, they were still playing like 4 and 5 bands at a time, doing 20 and 30 minutes. By 73, say, after Woodstock, post-Woodstock, into the early 70s, bands were going out on their own and doing 2 hours. And that changed everything. People took live performance much more seriously. The lighting and the PAs and everything improved so much. Yeah. And the 70s were crazy. Yeah. The young women were everywhere, and we were young men, and we were single, and we were into everything. Everything.
And for Cockney Rebel, it was really almost overnight success, wasn't it? You had six hit singles between 74 and 76. You wouldn't have known what had happened to you.
No, it was pretty overnight with me of the first Cockney Rebel. We had probably played only about six times in on stage, and that would have been in clubs before EMI signed us to a 3-album deal.
Wow.
So it wasn't it was close to what you might term overnight success, which kind of went against me, to be honest, because it made me come across in interview in the music press as a little bit cocky and arrogant. I wasn't really like that. My family wouldn't have allowed it, my upbringing. But uh-huh. I came across that way. It happened very quickly.
Why do you think that was?
Which bit?
Why do you think you came across like that?
Well, I did. You know, the music press, certainly in the UK, gave me a hard ride, which didn't bother me. I was 22, 23, 24. And in the charts everywhere. And I kind of, you think you can rule the world when you're that age, you know? Takes a lot of experience before you realize that you actually can't.
Yeah. Tell me what happened when you found out that Make Me Smile went to number one.
Oh, well, that was at 3 a.m. in the Chateau Marmont in Hollywood. EMI phoned from London to say it's gone to number one. We just finished our American tour in Los Angeles, middle of February 75. And what we did was the managing director called me privately, personally, got through to my hotel room in the Chateau. Did we get cut off again?
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. So much for WhatsApp.
No, it dropped.
It dropped out,
didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you were saying that the EMI manager called you in the room.
Oh, did we get that far?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. He called me in my hotel room and I said, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. And he said, yeah, but I knew you'd be up. And I was, and we all were. And I went and banged on their doors, and we all sort of cheered and shouted and raved and ranted and dived fully clothed into the outdoor swimming pool.
As you do.
Yeah, childish, as you did back then.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a big moment.
Is that the song that you're most proud of, do you think?
Oh, not at all. Not proud of. No, no. It's my pension for sure. It's the song I'm most grateful for. Yeah. It's got a life of its own. Make Me Smile. It's a strange thing to have, to be the curator of it, of that piece of work. It's a bit odd, but no, not proud so much.
Which one would claim the proud category?
Yeah, well, it would be something much more modern. It would be from the canon. Someone told me I've published 139, 140 songs. It would be something from my later years, Sandy. It would be something more sentimental that I was able to write once my children were grown up and everything. There are three songs that I will sing at pretty well every concert that I know mean the world to the listener, that I know I read what, you know, I read what audiences feel.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be The Coast of Amalfi, which is more than just about, it's not a travel log of an Italian holiday. It's got a lot of depth to it. And the coast of Amalfi reaches out and touches people. Then there's a song called Journey's End, which is like a paean to my children. But they're not maudlin. I don't do maudlin. What I do is I write it romantically and passionately and compassionately. And a song called A Friend for Life.
Nice.
It took a lot of... Rod Stewart has got that on his last album. Rod covered it on Another Country. You could hear Rod sing it. And
I think we'll have a listen to your version, I think.
I am very proud of it, to be honest. My version has a string quartet, and it's a song that I sing it on stage, all three of those songs, and with my eyes closed. And it doesn't matter if it's like an acoustic show to 300-400 people, which we do a lot of, or 3,000 indoors with a rock band, or a festival to 30,000. And I sing those songs if I do. And it's interesting, as you get older, you learn so much about yourself. I sing them with my eyes closed, and I can't concentrate. I think so deeply about the words I'm saying, speaking, singing, that I'm learning what they're about. I'm thinking, crikey, that's interesting. Is that what you were getting at? Is that what that means? And I'm talking to myself like in a daydream, as I perform in front of God knows how many people. If only they knew what was going through your mind. Performers are all like that. Not all, but those of us, Barry Gibb is like it. I saw him at his wonderful Glastonbury last year, and singing those incredible Bee Gees songs. Yeah, yeah. I mean, incredible songs. Yeah. What would you give for that catalogue?
Yeah.
Crikey. And Barry Gibb singing those words, and I could see his eyes looking out into the distance or closing, and I could tell that he was thinking, yeah, I wrote that with my brothers.
Amazing.
We wrote that.
Amazing feeling.
Yeah.
It would be.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Stevie, are you a romantic and passionate man by nature?
You must know I am. Are you kidding? Yeah, I wear my heart on my sleeve. I am, yeah. I put people first before materialism, and God knows I've got enough of that. But if the house burnt down, I'd look for people, not paintings and books. Yeah, I am. I'm a poetry reader, in a small way, as a songwriter. It's not true poetry. It's not perfect rhyme. We get away with murder in songs. But yeah, I love life. I like people very much, and that makes me romantic. There's no question. Huh.
And you think all of that was formed during your childhood experiences, or do you think it was formed by your childhood experiences?
Yeah, we're all. You know, obviously, we're informed by experience. Mine was a long way from... I'm one of five children. I'm the second of five. And I was away from the four siblings for 4 years, periods of time, over added up to 4 years. Did a lot of my schooling in hospital. You're informed by that experience. Yeah. But no. I mean, not everybody who was in hospital for a long time, suffering, whatever, not every one of us became a songwriter or a poet, a performer, not at all. So it's not a case of it will be because
of
that experience.
I understand that, but it certainly shaped your attitude towards life, I'd imagine.
Yeah. But is it maybe in my genes? I mean, I was reading poetry, T.S. Eliot, D.H. Lawrence. I was reading Hemingway and Steinbeck when I was 15, way outside the school syllabus, way outside, because I'd finished the syllabus, the curriculum, in hospital, because, you know, we did it alone. I wasn't at school with 25 other kids.
Yeah.
So I finished the curriculum quickly when I was 15 for our O-level exams. And the school started to send me extracurricular literature. And so, yeah, I read T.S. Eliot and realized that words tasted beautiful in your mouth. Words tasted full of quality and nuance, and words. And then reading Samuel Beckett a bit later, you realize that literature, Shakespeare, words can be musical. And I always had music in me. My mother was a jazz singer.
Yeah, I read that.
My great-grandfather was a church organist. So there was always music in my soul. And reading great literature and realizing how musical it was. I read Dante in Italian.
Wow.
I don't fully understand it. I've got the English translation on one page and the opposite page is the original comedy, you know, Divine Comedy. And I read that and you know, again, it tastes like bolognese in your mouth. Per me si va tra la perduta gente.
Nice.
It's just so beautiful. Yeah.
I'd rather chocolate than bolognese, but I get what you're saying. Steve, at 70, are you getting better with the songwriting and what's coming out of you? Is it improving with age?
Oh, it's hard. It's hard. It's tough. It's tough. When you've been doing it so long, and I told you I'm not a materialist, but I collect material goods. It's what you do. You earn the money and you buy a painting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my house is like a gallery. It's just paintings everywhere, quality prints. It's just beautiful. It's wonderful. It's just, the walls are covered in art. My bookshelves are heaving with good, great literature. When you've got all that, and two children in their 30s, now three. My third grandchild was born two weeks ago.
Oh, congratulations.
Bless you, tiny little baby. She's gorgeous. Just the size of a rabbit. it's just wonderful, this miracle of life. And when you've got decent children, how old is your own daughter, Sandy?
My eldest daughter, I've got three daughters. My eldest is 36 and she's now got a six-month-old. So I know what you're talking about.
Oh, there you are.
Yeah.
You know exactly what I'm saying.
I sure do.
You do. And isn't it good?
Yeah.
It's good.
So
the grandparent thing is good.
So does that mean that...
I'll just quickly wrap that up by saying when you've acquired this materialism and you've raised good people, decent people you're proud of, yeah?
Yeah.
When that's happened, and, you know, I've acquired all this materialism and I've got 19 guitars and, you know, it's just business for me. It's what I do. I play concerts and people pay me a load of money. But when you've got that, to try and sit and seriously write a lyric that you think other people would want to hear, it's difficult because I'm not angry and I'm not hungry. It's difficult. I'm working on it. I'm working on it. I never stop. But the standard I seem to have raised the bar for myself, only for myself.
Yeah.
Where I'm scared to put it out into the public domain because it might not be up to scratch, the lyric. You know, I'm writing tunes by the dozen. Every week I'm writing, all the time I'm playing guitar and piano. The lyric thing, I don't know. I'm telling you, the best work is often done when... Huh?
You think you're overthinking it?
Good question. I often tell my wife, and I told my son about 2 weeks ago on another big issue. I mean, he's a lawyer. He doesn't need telling. But I say that to them. Look, you're overthinking this. You know, keep it simple. It's simpler. And maybe I am, but I need psychologist or psychiatry to tell me that. Someone's got to say to me in therapy, you're overthinking this. You can still write a decent lyric. You can write meaningful words. You can. Well, see, I don't think I can.
It's interesting. But
I'm probably.
You probably were. Yeah, you were probably, definitely more cocky in your 20s than you obviously are now.
Yeah, well, you know, I think in all art forms, the best work is done when we're hungry. That's in our 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. Picasso carried on late in life, making absolutely fantastic work. But not many do. Matisse did.
Yeah.
Not many.
Well,
not
we would
many.
Certainly like you to keep carrying on as long as you feel the urge. Steve Harley, you've got it all. And we thank you for making us all smile, because you do.
Oh, bless you. Bless you. It's been a real joy talking to you.